Hey, Harpy Hour fans. There's a new way to earn yourselves a coveted Harpy Hour logo sticker and get a shout out from us in an episode.
Just tag us at Harpy Hour Pod on an original social media post. So not a retweet, but something you wrote yourself telling your friends how much you love us.
Next, DM us your mailing address straight from your social media account or email us along with a screenshot of your post to harpyhourpodcast@gmail.com.
You won't get another sticker if you already got one in our last giveaway, but let your friends know anyways so they can participate and get a matching sticker.
We're only giving away up to 20 stickers, but if you miss out, you can also get one by supporting us on Patreon.
Now, before you enjoy the episode, check out this promo from another awesome podcast to add to your list and stick around for Harpy Hour.
Leave the Lights On is a true crime podcast with a paranormal twist. Join creator Eliza and her co-host as they explore terrifying true stories and chilling crimes. Growing up, Eliza had an odd obsession with the darkest desires of humanity and an insatiable curiosity about the afterlife. Now, each week, Eliza brings you tales that will make you want to lock your doors, hide in your room, and of course, leave the lights on. Available on Spotify and Apple Podcast.
Harpy Hour may contain explicit language, as well as graphic, violent, and sexual content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Harpy Hour.
Welcome.
When I say harpy, you say hour. Harpy.
Hour.
Harpy.
Hour.
Yay.
We did it.
I did a new thing, guys.
When I say we're the harpies, you introduce yourselves. We're the harpies.
I'm Tracy.
Steph.
Oh, I'm sorry. Liz.
God damn it, Steph. Every time.
I thought we had to do it all at once.
No, that's not. No. No.
I'm Steph.
The instructions weren't very clear.
They were
hashtag
not.
Steph ruins everything. My favorite hashtag.
Hashtag not my fault.
And this is our... I was reading the wrong thing.
Podcast. You're looking for podcast. The word podcast.
No, I had scrolled down too far.
And this is our shit show where we stumble around not knowing what we're doing.
I was going to read... This is our extra content, but it's not our extra content.
No, this is regular content.
Podcast.
This is our podcast where we share ridiculous stories in history, science, and entertainment.
We try.
Oh my God.
No guarantees.
So we just recorded the previous week's episode. Like, we have back-to-back episodes. And in last week's episode, we talked about hashtag Hamill facts. It made me think of hashtag muffin facts for some reason.
What? Is that a thing?
I don't know why my brain went to that, but it reminded me of... Did you guys ever watch muffinfilms.com?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of.
It sounds familiar. God. I can't put a picture in my head right now, but it sounds very familiar.
So it's copyright the year 2000. And Exactly. And it's these films, and you click... So when you go to muffinfilms.com, it shows like a muffin tin, and in each one, and each of the little muffin like holes is a number, and you click on the number and it shows different films, and they're kind of in the same like style of End of the World.
Oh, like that flash video kind
of
thing.
Yeah, the animation is in that same style.
Yeah, it's like flash videos, yeah.
And it's amazing.
Okay,
amazing.
I have it up right now. I see what you're doing. There's like a woman. She got to a muffin tree.
It's yes.
Like one
yes.
15 second thing.
Yes.
She's picking muffins off the muffin tree. She just fell asleep under the muffin tree.
Yes. So I'm embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed. I am proud to say that I rewatched the muffin films. They hold up.
Oh, she just got fat.
Yeah. Yeah, she gets fat and then she dies.
Now she's body slamming the muffin tree and just eating the muffins off the ground.
I'm still confused how you got from Hamill facts to muffin facts.
Well, I was thinking of other like hashtag facts. And
well, it's not muffin facts. It's muffin
It's
films.
Not, but I think muffin films and muffin facts, like the fact that it was like a double, like Hamel, like two syllables.
Okay.
And then,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, now there's green muffins and she just ate a green muffin.
It's poisonous. It's poisonous. Don't eat it.
Oh, she ate it already. Uh oh.
She dies.
Oh, God. She just died.
Spoiler. She dies.
I remember I took like a computer graphics class and I had to make a little flash video like this too.
This was like the beginning of those, like, of like YouTube.
Yeah, this is like Homestar Runner era. Did you guys watch Homestar Runner?
I loved Homestar Runner.
Yes, yes.
I loved Homestar Runner. That was so much fun.
Yeah, it was like the predecessor for that.
I'll rewatch all of those later.
I love Strong Bad Emails. They were my favorite.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what that made me think of, was the time I watched muffin films as a 33-year-old adult.
I'm going to go down the Homestar Runner rabbit hole later on.
Oh, yeah. Homestar Runner, Salad Fingers. Was that his name? Remember, guys, Salad Fingers?
Oh, yeah. I think it is Salad Fingers.
He had like lettuce fingers and he would just like touch things.
British animated series. Yeah.
Yeah, like this. What, he's touching a spoon or something? I don't remember.
No. Do you remember the one? It was like, my anus is bleeding.
Oh, yeah.
The rejected cartoons. Yeah.
My spoon is too big.
My spoon is too big. Yes.
I am a banana. I feel like Liz doesn't know what we're talking about because she's not commenting.
Nope, yep. No. Don't know these ones.
I am a banana.
And how?
Anyway, Liz, what are you harping on today?
Well, I have a special topic today that was chosen by one of our lovely friends and Patreon supporters.
And they always pick Liz.
I'm the favored harpy, it seems.
I mean,
amongst our donors.
I think it's because they know that you will take it seriously, whereas if
all of our donors have been people that we know, and they know that Liz will do the research to do it, due diligence.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this friend is Kate. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Who is Liz's friend from college?
Yes.
High school?
College.
Okay.
And she is an honorary harpy, which you can be too.
Yep.
If you go on to Patreon.
Do
and
it.
And support Harpy Hour Pod.
Which you should.
Absolutely, you should.
Kate chose a topic that is very important to her, as it should be important to all of us, everybody.
Okay.
And
we don't know what the topic is yet.
Right.
Yeah, no idea.
Yeah,
right,
we don't know.
She directed this to me, so you guys are hearing this for the first time.
Correct.
But I want to reiterate the warnings that we have at the beginning of our podcast about sensitive content. This could be a triggering topic to some people. And due to its sensitive nature, I'm not going to tease you guys. I just want to be straightforward to you and our listeners about what the topic is.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
So I did give it a title. I'm calling it The Silent Pandemic. And this was taken from an article by Harvard. They called it the Silent Second Pandemic. Others have called it the Shadow Pandemic. So Kate has asked that I talk about gender-based violence, essentially. So domestic violence or sexual assault, but particularly in the context of the pandemic. You know, how the pandemic has shaped how these types of things occur and how we respond to them.
Okay.
So it's going to be a little ragey.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Okay, are you ready?
As I'm going to be.
So I also want just to make a statement that we're talking sort of big picture here, and it is not my intent to be like gratuitously graphic or obscene or anything like that. So just trying to be sensitive with the topic.
Okay.
But I'm going to start with a true story that happened recently during the pandemic. And even though this story is public, like it essentially went viral over the last few months, I am not going to use the real names in order to protect the privacy of those involved.
Okay.
So we're gonna use the names Jane and John, like the Does. You know them. The woman in this story, we'll call her Jane. She and John are in a relationship together. I don't know how long they have been in a relationship, but it seems to be a tumultuous one. And so we know that there was at least one fight that happened in December of 2020. She described it as a particularly nasty fight, in which she sent her young daughter to go stay with family afterwards. So she has a young daughter, presumably from a different relationship, that was living with her at their home. And after this fight with John, she sends the daughter to go stay with family. It was that bad.
And when you say it was a particularly nasty fight, are we saying, is it abusive at this point? Like, was there abuse?
This is the, that she describes it as a nasty fight. And okay. That is all we know about that situation.
Okay.
Based on the following fight, I think we can assume that it was physically abusive.
Okay.
Cut a couple months later to February, there's another fight. This time the cops are called and John is arrested. And he is arrested for and charged for assault with the intent to commit great bodily harm.
Jeez.
Less than the crime of murder.
Well, because she's not dead.
So he wasn't trying to kill her.
But trying to fuck her up.
But less than attempted murder is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we don't know, again, the details necessarily, nor do we need to go into them. But so we know that the cops come. He is charged for assault against her.
Okay.
He is later released on bond pending the results of the case. So, like, until they have the trial and find him guilty, like, he is free to go, or innocent, I suppose, pending the results of the trial.
But he's not, spoiler mm-hmm. alert.
Yeah. Okay. But he is issued a no contact order.
Okay.
Then in March, we have the Zoom trial. So everything up to this point is, like, not national news, you know.
Okay.
It makes national news when the lawyer is actually a cat.
I am not a cat.
I'm ready to proceed.
But I'm okay
My
with
favorite video. Oh, it's so good.
It's the best thing that came out of the pandemic. I'm ready to proceed.
That's exactly what a cat lawyer would
say. It appears to be a filter. Yes, it's a filter.
No, I thought a cat was testifying. Amazing. Okay. Anyway, back to this horribly sad case.
Sorry. I had to light it up for a hot second.
I hope at this point all of our listeners are familiar with Cat Lawyer. Who turns out to be a shady character.
Yeah.
As is later determined that he, like, used his position and funds to, like,
harass,
intimidate his former girlfriend or mistress or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He may look cute and fluffy.
Get
but
her
he's
business
not.
Shut down and stuff like that.
Yeah.
This highlights, you know, the fact that a lot of court proceedings are happening remotely now.
Sure.
And so that includes the particular hearing here for this case. And as I mentioned, this happens in March, so this is fairly recently. And this town, they're in a Midwestern state. They have a Zoom hearing. Everybody calls in separately, like the judge, the prosecutors, the defendant. Jane is the witness.
Oh my God, I think I know what this is.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was a somewhat viral.
I know what this is now.
Article, so this might be familiar to some of you all.
So far, I don't recognize it.
They begin the trial. The prosecutor starts asking the woman, Jane, what happened the night of the fight. She answers very, like, short and simple statements. She's hesitant to go into, like, any kind of detail. So she basically just says that her and her then boyfriend, quote, argued, and that the police came.
It's very passive language.
So she's asked, why did the police come? And she says, because the police were called. They came here. So again, still very passive. And she's asked who called the police. And she says, technically me. So, she was the one that called, but she's hesitant to give these details. And meanwhile, the prosecutor is making some observations and notices, like, fidgety behavior and, like, looking away from the camera, like looking off screen. But so she notices some interesting behaviors that they're both exhibiting on their cameras. And the prosecutor says, quote, Your Honor, I have reason to believe that the defendant, who's John, the alleged abuser, is in the same apartment as the complaining witness right now.
Yep.
And I'm extremely scared for her safety.
Oh.
I want some confirmation that she is safe before we continue. So everything after this seems to unfold really quickly. The judge asks both Jane and John to provide their address. Like, where are you right now calling into this meeting from? Jane gives her home address. John gives a different address. And so the judge says, like, I'm sending officers to your address to make sure that you're okay. And in the meantime, asks John to go outside and show everybody his address. Like, okay, like, you told me you're at 123 Main Street. I want you to walk outside with your camera and show me the numbers, like, 123 on your door or on your mailbox. Like, prove to me that you are at the address you say you are.
Show me
evidence. Oh.
Yeah, trying to, you know, verify.
Definitely do not know this case. This is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. John claims that his battery's low. He's only at like 2% right now and that he's plugged in. And so if he were to go do as the judge requested and show everybody the address, like, his phone would die. So he's basically like, no, I can't. I can't show you my address. But sooner or later, the cops arrive, and lo and behold, John is in Jane's apartment.
Yep.
Oh.
So he is intimidating her during his hearing.
Shit.
And the hearing quickly comes to an end.
Yeah.
He had, in fact, been calling in to his hearing from the daughter's bedroom. So basically, you kind of see, like, the police arrive because they're both there on their cameras. And so you see the police arrive and they take him into custody. And he's immediately like, we don't want the no contact order. We don't want it.
The guy is saying that? John is saying that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. We don't want it.
Yeah. So he is then taken back into custody and his bond is canceled. So this is the story that goes viral.
Wow.
That all of this unfolded on this Zoom meeting. And so we're going to break this down into, like, a few different components. So up until the hearing, also, John never knew that Jane was the one who called the cops. So, like, I guess she was able to do so discreetly. And, like, maybe he assumed that the neighbors called the cops or somebody else did. And so she was trying to, like, protect herself. She didn't want to anger him.
Right. By, and she's in the same fucking room.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. By having him know that she was the one that actually, like, called on him. And she has to, you know, she's in this position where he's in her apartment intimidating her, but she's also, she doesn't want to lie.
Right.
And so she's, like, in this very uncomfortable and dangerous situation.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
The headline that I read when I first saw this article was, like, hero prosecutor saves woman in distress. And it was all kind of like praising the prosecutor for recognizing this situation and putting an end to it. And yes, that's valid. Thank you, prosecutor. But that's kind of not highlighting the real, like, underlying issue, which is that, you know, domestic violence and witness intimidation like this are not unique situations. Like, these happen all the time. We don't see it, and it's worse during the pandemic. When the story goes viral, Jane comes forward and she gives a few interviews and she talks publicly about her case. She says, quote, I know everybody thinks I'm an idiot for staying in the relationship. A lot of people are saying, so she's referring to, like, comments that she's read, like, on sure, threads and stuff like that.
Because it went viral. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people are saying, well, it's her fault.
Well, that's victim blaming.
All of these people who have no clue. People think it's clear cut. Why wouldn't you just leave? It's just so much more complicated than that.
And when you leave is the most dangerous time.
Yes.
Like, when you finally decide to leave an abusive relationship, that's...
Or it can be.
Can be the most dangerous time in terms of, like, things will escalate. Things will get out of hand.
Right.
Just, like, well, statistically.
I'm sure Liz is going to get to that.
Yeah. Just statistically, that's the more dangerous time.
And so she highlights a lot of infuriating misconceptions about abusive relationships and, like, that it's just so easy to leave and that, you know, you should know better. But there's a million reasons why people stay. You know, there could be the children's safety, as well as your own safety, you know, there's coercion, threats, brainwashing, love, you know, regardless of all the things that are happening.
Control.
I think a lot of it is just like the mind fuckery. Like, I was talking to someone about this yesterday, a friend of mine, and he was in an abusive relationship where his girlfriend was doing things to him that were essentially abusive. And he was talking about how, like, but he was still, like, so in love with her and he loved her family and mm-hmm. stuff. And when it was good, the times were good. And when it was bad, obviously it was very bad. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, I feel like I've been in a bad relationship before, you guys know, where, like, it's easy to be, like, hang on to the good times and just, like, overlook mm-hmm. the bad times. I've never been in a mm-hmm. physically abusive relationship before, but just, like, in general, a bad relationship.
And mental and psychological abuse are.
Exactly.
That's still domestic violence.
Right. And yeah. so like
or intimate partner violence, like those are still mm-hmm. relationships.
Right. And you get removed from it and you're like, what the fuck was I thinking? But when you're in it, it's just like, well, the good times are good, like or whatever, you know, you just make some justification yeah. or whatever.
Yeah. Even when you're removed. And I mean, that person could have more than just like mind control over you. They could, you know, a lot of finances. Those relationships have financial abuse.
Children, finances, family, like right. other, you know, exactly. they might be the one who holds the lease or whatever. There's so many other things that play into those kinds of situations. Right. It's not as simple as just like cutting ties and going sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. Another component of her story that is worth talking about is another aspect of how the pandemic has contributed to domestic violence or intimate partner violence.
Yeah.
Some unique features of how that is being handled. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we know COVID has shut down courthouses. That's how we got Lawyer Cat and mm-hmm. this case. So
not everything is a blessing like Lawyer Cat.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Blessing and a curse. So officials have needed to find new ways to host their proceedings and make them open to the public. And one of those solutions has been Zoom meetings or other such, you know, public recording platforms. And how different counties or different authorities implement this is different. So some can't be recorded or are only recorded by, you know, the courthouse and saved internally and are just like part of public record but need to like be requested to be viewed again, whereas others, like in this woman's case, are posted to YouTube forever.
Oh Jesus. Yeah.
Where their story can be told.
Yeah, I don't like that.
800,000 times, which is what happened to her.
Yeah, I don't like that.
I'm guessing they did not get her permission.
Well, it's public record.
Yeah. And that's like, technically, these types of proceedings are not confidential. They're yeah. public record.
Yeah.
Mm. But just the dynamic of how we've shifted to this virtual world has really changed what that means for a person's privacy. Yeah. Right. This is what like a lot of gender-based violence or crisis advocates are having conversations about, how mm-hmm. our switch to these virtual courtrooms has made this like trade-off between transparency and privacy. So mm-hmm. these types of proceedings are supposed to be transparent, but to what extent? You know, what should be acceptable? And at what point do we have to adjust what we consider to be transparent for the sake of somebody's privacy and safety? One crisis advocate says that, quote, the positive side of the of this video going viral is that the whole world gets to see what domestic violence victims live with day in and day out.
I mean, I'm sure Jane Doe sees it that way, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Because if you were to say or ask what percentage of domestic violence cases involve intimidation like this, I would say 100%.
I would absolutely say yes. 100%.
Just that you don't get to see it. It's really unfortunate that this happened to this woman, the violence in the first place, and that the story went viral the way yeah. that it did. But if there is any positive side out right. of this, it's that it opens a conversation about that this is happening and that we're not seeing yeah. it, but we should be seeing it.
I mean, it's a personal tragedy that hopefully mm-hmm. you hope, you know, brings some visibility to people who can help and change that situation.
Many people out there are experiencing situations similar as a result of being cooped up at home. Mm-hmm. You're less likely to be seen or you know, to get help, and you're more dependent than ever on your partners. Yep. So,
and you're locked in an apartment with them.
Exactly. So a woman named Judith Lewis Herman, she's a renowned trauma expert. She says that common tools of abuse include, and so these are like tools that an abuser uses to like manipulate mm-hmm. another person. Mm-hmm. Those tools of abuse include isolation from friends,
yeah,
family and employment, mm-hmm. constant surveillance, strict detailed rules for behavior, and restrictions on access to basic necessities such as food, clothing, and sanitary facilities. And if that sounds familiar, that is just the conditions that everybody has been stuck with during the pandemic. And so the pandemic has really, unfortunately, provided even more opportunity for abusers or, you know, abusive type individuals to inflict control or violence on an intimate partner.
Right.
Because all of the things that they would create to form that control are just like being handed to them. Like,
Right.
We can't go anywhere. And like it slides by a little bit more easily because you're less likely to have a concerned friend say, oh, so-and-so hasn't, you know, come out.
Well, yeah,
come
out in a while.
They can't
for a
while. See you, so they don't.
Yeah. And yeah, so like, and people aren't asking questions because we're all stuck at home and it's normal.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The bar is infinitely raised at this point for what is for what trips our alarm bells.
Right. Yeah, but there are a lot of campaigns out there that have slogans such as stay at home is not safe at home. And mm-hmm. that is sadly true for all sorts of individuals. So not just survivors of domestic violence. You know, there's child abuse, elder abuse.
Yeah.
The physically disabled homeless residents or those with mental illnesses or substance abuses are all also being essentially victimized by just the physical circumstances and limitations of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Other ways that the pandemic has impacted communities include closing of shelters or limited capacity in shelters. Mm-hmm. So again, that includes, you know, shelters for survivors of domestic violence or also just recovery for alcohol or substance abuse.
Yeah.
These individuals are essentially being like put out on the street because there's restrictions in how many, you know, people you can have in a shelter.
Without getting too much into it, this is a problem that I have, from an ER standpoint, encountered because there are a lot of people who come to the ER mm-hmm. for social work type needs like shelter, mm-hmm. detox, rehab, mm-hmm. crisis, things like that. And they need places to go. And it's gotten better recently as the pandemic has eased a little bit, especially here in Hawaii. I guess I can't speak worldwide, but here in Hawaii, things are not so bad in terms of COVID numbers. So things have gotten a little easier. But during the height, there were definitely times where it was just a struggle of like, this person, whether it was like, I need to test this person for COVID. Okay, they have it and they're homeless. Where do I put them now? That's safe mm-hmm. for them and safe for mm-hmm. the world, you know, safe for society. And also just like people in these situations where they need housing for other reasons, it's become like an issue of where can I put them? What are the resources available? What are the limitations? And sometimes there aren't any options and it's just really frustrating to deal with.
Yeah.
How to help these people who really need it, you know?
Yeah. Some countries like France, Italy, and Spain, and some U.S. states or jurisdictions have used vacant hotel rooms as makeshift shelters to, you know, provide housing for people who need it while still kind of keeping them isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's highlighted that in Europe and in the U.S., we really rushed to lock down. And granted, from a global health perspective, that seems like the most immediate solution is for the pandemic was, you know, this great lockdown, but it was all done without making sufficient provisions for, you know, victims of those communities. And so within several weeks of lockdown, calls to sexual assault hotlines increased in many countries and the public stepped up to, you know, demand assistance from the government. And so we have seen some funding in different states and different countries go out to boost support for crisis centers and, you know, social support services. Those are all that money we really need, like always, like not just during the pandemic. You know, a lot of these crisis centers are saying like, this is great, but like we need this long term, like not just these like booster funds.
Right.
And you're probably going to touch on this, but we don't necessarily have, or I feel like in general, governments and society doesn't have always the means to respond to all of that. Like social workers, I feel like there's never enough social workers.
That's kind of what I was...
I watched a Netflix series recently. It was like a documentary series. It was like the trials of Gabriel something. I forget his last name. I'm sorry. But it was like a child who was like routinely abused. Yeah. And then his family, his parents eventually abused him to the point that he died. And there was like the whole trial that went after that. It was like a true crime documentary.
Right.
And the teacher reported over and over and over again signs of abuse. Like she made phone calls to like some, you know, CPS or whatever. And like nothing ever really got done because there was just too many cases for the number of social workers. They would like check in on him and be like, he's fine. Like 5-minute visit or whatever, you know, and it just happened over and over and over again. So I feel like even when we recognize these things, there isn't always like the means to respond to it. It's just like a huge problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is in part what I was alluding to earlier with like extra funds being provided. So
yeah, we need them there all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Now
pivot a little bit. We've been talking, I mean, mostly about domestic violence, and there's certainly a Venn diagram with domestic violence and sexual assault. Just to sort of clarify on the difference, domestic violence is sometimes referred to as intimate partner violence, it's also kind of an umbrella because it can be not just between intimate partners, it can be other types of family violence like elder or child abuse. And sexual assault are actions that result in the loss or removal of a person's sexual autonomy. And so that can be rape, sharing explicit photos without consent. And so those are, as I said, can be overlapping or can be entirely unrelated. So, you know, a sexual assault that happens at a nightclub is not necessarily domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even outside of the pandemic, so any type of state of emergency, natural disaster, conflict, or health crisis, any such emergency, evidence shows that such an emergency increases the rate of sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And a recent example of that is Hurricane Katrina, where sexual assault increased by 45% during the hurricane and the recovery period.
Wow.
40% of rape crisis centers surveyed over the pandemic said that they saw an increased demand for services since the outbreak. But hospitals are performing fewer sexual assault forensic exams, so SAFE kits or rape kits as they are referred to.
Hmm.
It seems contradictory, right? More people are reaching out for services. Fewer people are presenting at hospitals for these cases. And so it's important to look at the big picture or the context of what's happening. So if you were just looking at the hospital data alone, you would be like, oh, cases have gone down. Like, you know, people are behaving. And like, that is absolutely not the case. And so, you know, people have looked at the hospital data and said, this doesn't make sense. Like the conditions indicate like that the situation should be worse, and calls to crisis centers or social services or other support centers have increased. One of the reasons that there might be that difference is, as one advocate says, the reporting of sexual violence and disasters is often considered a, quote, luxury issue, something that is further down on the hierarchy of needs for disaster victims. So, you know, I think, Steph, you can attest to this. People who have been skipping going to the emergency room for like actual medical emergencies because it's a pandemic.
Yeah. ER volumes have actually, it sounds, you wouldn't expect it in a pandemic, but overall nationwide, not just here in Hawaii, but I've heard about it in other parts of the country too, where like patient volumes in the emergency room have actually gone down during the pandemic because people coming in for other reasons who are less severe or like, you know, that people push off things, either like, oh, it's not truly an emergency, I can go somewhere else, or like, I'll hold off, I don't want to go to the ER because I'm afraid of getting COVID there or whatever. So actually ER volumes have gone down during the pandemic, despite the fact that the ones that are coming in with COVID and such are obviously very sick. So
yeah,
it's been weird. I would never have predicted that in a pandemic ER volumes would be down.
And so that could be for a variety of reasons that you mentioned. It could be that they perceive it to not be a priority. You know, the system is overburdened.
Mm-hmm.
The healthcare system is overburdened, or the
fear. I think a lot of it's fear.
Law enforcement system is overburdened. And so they just don't think that they are a priority to be treated, or fear of COVID. They don't want to be exposed to, you know, another health issue in an attempt to resolve another issue.
Specifically on the since we're talking about sexual violence, I didn't know this until I became part of the healthcare system, but there are specific hospitals who have SANE nurses. It stands for sexual assault nurse something, examiners, I think. And they are specially trained to take samples for like rape kits, take pictures, like do things in an appropriate way that is collection, like evidence collection. And not just every hospital has that. So even if you're going to like the major hospital in the area, they may not be the hospital that has the SANE nurses. So I've worked at hospitals that are not SANE nurse hospitals. And then it turns out they're like, well, we have to transfer you to this other place. And so this person who's already overwhelmed by their situation is now finding out that I have to go to a second hospital, and sometimes it's just too much and they don't want to do it.
There's been a movement to add more of those to like college campuses, hospitals associated with it.
You know, it's really hard to talk to these people and to like, you know, try to convince them to do it. And sometimes they just don't want to do it. They're like, I'm already too taxed. I'm already too emotionally over this and at my limit. And I just, the idea of having to be transferred across town now is just like too much, and they don't do it. And that's probably part of the problem too.
Yeah, I read one article, and this was a case that was from like the early 2000s. One woman had been sexually assaulted at, you know, a party or a nightclub or something. And in the morning, she went to her nearest or local emergency department, and they told that they don't have the kits like at this hospital. Right. And they told her to leave and just go to the other hospital, which was like inconveniently across town. Mm-hmm. And like, she was in part like discouraged, and like it was not easy to get there. And so she ended up like going home, resting, and then she, you know, made it to the other hospital later in the afternoon. And so at that point, it had been like 12 hours since she had presented at the first hospital. And basically, like, they had done the rape kit, but we're basically like, too much time has passed now for us to like
reliably collect enough evidence or whatever.
Yeah, because she had been given Xanax according to the test results. And they were like, well, it's been so long now, like, we can't determine. Like, you could have taken Xanax in the morning.
Right. All we can say is there's Xanax in your system. We can't say how it ended up there. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is like, sometimes getting an ambulance to transfer a patient from one hospital to another, it might, if it's not like an emergency, by the emergency I mean like heart attack, stroke, like something that is, you know, super emergent, or you will
die time
imminently,
is limited.
Right. Like a trauma, whatever. If it's not one of those situations, sometimes an ambulance can take a few hours. So sometimes we do tell patients, like, if you're welcome to go by your own vehicle, or you're welcome to take an Uber or whatever in certain situations. And that might be one of those situations where like, it would be faster for you to just drive there yourself right now than for us to transfer you by ambulance. Which do you prefer to do? And they might choose, like, I'll drive myself. And then, you know, that can happen sometimes. They change their mind midway or whatever, or they decide to wait a little bit longer. And it's very frustrating. It's a very frustrating system to be part of, because you want to do the right thing. And sometimes it's not easy.
Yeah, so SANE was for sexual assault nurse examiners.
Okay, I got it right.
You might also see SAFE, sexual assault forensic examiners, which is also the name of the kit. Like, sexual assault forensic exam is what the exam they perform. I spoke to Kate in preparing for this segment because, you know, as I mentioned, she chose this topic. It's really important to her. And she used to be she volunteered for a while as an advocate. And I've been going back and forth a little bit between victim and survivor, like depending on the context. Typically, the more accepted term to refer to these individuals as survivors, and I'll try to stick with that. The individuals themselves might say, no, I'm a victim. Like if that's how they feel, if they feel victimized. But generally speaking, like advocacy partners and groups try to use the terminology survivor. You know, I talked to Kate about her experience being an advocate. And so to give you a little bit of that information, typically when a survivor presents themselves at the hospital, the SANE nurse is contacted as well as an advocate. So there are advocacy groups that have these partnerships or agreements with hospitals. And the advocate is essentially like a counselor. So she kind of describes the hospital itself. In this case, the patient stays at the hospital for the exam, but the hospital is kind of like a hotel room where like they're not really like treating the patient. They're just like housing them, putting them up, like maybe giving them some ibuprofen and some food, but it's generally like a place where they stay and hang out until their SANE nurse arrives and their advocate. The nurse is there to collect the evidence and gather everything that would be needed to be handed over to law enforcement and be presented at a trial. Whereas the advocate, which was Kate's role, would be essentially to provide the counseling services or just simply be there as a person for support. And so, you know, the advocate can't be called on to testify. They're kind of just like in the shadows. It seems like, you know, they come in, they provide, you know, in addition to resources, it seems like one of the most important roles is just like an emotional support system.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, some individuals might come into the hospital with a friend or a family member, but some might come alone. And so the advocate would be the person that is there to support you. You know, they don't see you as a victim or as a survivor, just, you know, a person who needs to hold somebody's hand and support you. Some survivors that show up to a hospital still might decline the advocate services. They just might not want to deal with another person. In which case they maybe just like hand over some pamphlets and they leave. But more commonly, they want the advocates to stay. But some survivors might even decline the SANE nurse, which makes me really sad. So, you know, you might come in to the hospital just to be treated for injuries or be tested for, you know, disease or STDs. And then leave. Like you might just come in only wanting to address those issues and like completely decline the rape kit or any other services.
And there's also, I don't know if you're going to mention this at all, but getting the SANE exam done and collecting the forensic evidence does not automatically trigger police and be like, I'm going to prosecute. And I think sometimes that's something people don't understand is like, well, I don't want to, maybe it's someone they know or something like that. And they're not sure yet if they want to go forward and prosecute or whatever. But I have to, you know, when it's my situation, I'm dealing with someone in that situation, I tell them, you know, doing this is just, we can put it there and like, we can hold on to it, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're prosecuting this person, but this collecting this evidence is time limited. So you can collect it and you can decide not to do anything with it, but it doesn't mean you're going to prosecute the person. And that's something that it's hard to explain to people too, because sometimes that's what the deciding factor is in their brain. Well, I'm not going to prosecute anyway, or they're never going to find the guy anyway. So what's the point, you know?
Yeah. There's Kate definitely mentions that kind of hesitancy that, you know, there's hesitancy just to get the kit done in the first place in many cases.
And it's also invading when you're already just been violated, you know?
And yeah. And then when you get
personal,
the kit,
intimate thing,
yeah. And then when you get the kit done, many choose like not to charge right away.
Right.
So I think in general, they can be held for 30 days without having without pressing a charge, but that can also be renewed. The survivor can say I'm still not ready, or I don't know yet if I want to proceed with anything. And so they can hold, they just continue to hold on to that kit.
I think they won't do any tests on that kit unless you're prosecuting, but they will still collect it.
Yeah.
So you can't get the test and find out who it is yourself or whatever without getting police involved, but you can get you can get it collected and just store it and make a decision later.
Yeah. It sounded like it gets turned, it gets collected and it goes, it gets turned over right away, but they don't process it
right
until you're ready to press charges. And that happens a lot. That hesitancy, they don't get processed right away in many cases. You also just mentioned how physically uncomfortable it can be to even have the exams done.
Mm-hmm.
One area of warning where I'll get maybe a little graphic, when you get when you're at a routine gynecological exam, there's lube for the speculum generally to make it more comfortable, but that can damage the evidence in an exam.
Mm-hmm.
So after already being violated or assaulted, have to get this extra uncomfortable exam done. And so that's something that Kate mentions, having somebody to just literally hold your hand in the room with you is such a huge role of an advocate. But all of this is to say that in the pandemic, advocates can't be there.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
There are a lot of limitations on, who can be around for different tests or procedures.
No hand-holding
like that.
During COVID.
Exactly. Yeah. Other things other than emotional support that Kate indicated, the advocates are also typically the ones that provide certain types of materials to the survivors to make them more comfortable. So particularly if you have to give up any of your clothes for evidence, Kate says advocates carry a Ziploc bag of underwear in all sizes so that you have clean underwear to leave the hospital with.
Yeah.
And so those and, candy and magazines for while you're waiting. Because as you mentioned, Steph, the timing.
Yeah.
Kate says that one of her shortest interactions was 2 minutes. Somebody didn't want to see an advocate, and so she just handed over some pamphlets with some information for them to refer to, and that was it. Her longest was 8.5 hours, because that's how long it took for a SANE nurse to arrive with a kit.
Ugh.
They're lucky that the person didn't just give up and leave, because they didn't want to be there anymore. And that probably happens too many times. Sadly, as I mentioned, advocates still cannot be present in many hospitals right now to support survivors. Exams are still available. The CDC has stepped up and has issued guidance to health departments to indicate that treatment of assault cases is still a priority, and hospitals should continue to be prepared to treat patients and conduct the exams. The World Health Organization has also issued guidance about care for survivors of sexual violence, indicating that at minimum, hospitals should continue to treat physical injuries, aid in pregnancy prevention, treatment of sexually transmitted diseases, and where appropriate, HIV post-exposure prophylaxis. So there's still a lot of emphasis that, when survivors do present at the hospital, that they are treated and examined. But in all of these, guidance memos and what have you, there's not the appropriate emphasis on the advocate groups. And so those individuals are not able to be present. And also just if somebody brought a friend or a loved one, you can't have extra people with you for these types of, visits. So very sadly, those who are presenting at hospitals are very alone in getting examined or treated.
I think right now in the pandemic, that probably varies hospital to hospital. I mean, my own hospital's policy is fluctuated so much about visitors.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But like most, my quick scan of advocacy groups or crisis centers in a few different states showed that they were all doing remote services. So the hospital, the receiving hospital, or the same nurse can provide the survivor with information to contact their local crisis center, or maybe even just already have them on the phone and say, here, would you like to talk with them? But it's not the same as somebody physically standing in front of you and saying, I'm here.
Yeah, that's
like,
not the same.
Yeah, like, would you like me to stay? How can I help you? Those kinds of things.
Yep.
One advocacy group, the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence, they actually created like a little video that the SANE nurses can show to survivors. So it's just like this little like YouTube short video that SANE nurses are encouraged to play for a survivor when they see them, so that the survivors can like actually see the faces of people who would be available to support them. And so that was sort of their best solution to make that connection while still having to be remote. Advocacy groups are trying to find ways to get the survivors' attention and try to encourage them to actually use their services and to not be discouraged just because they're not there in person.
That's interesting. That's like an interesting workaround.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just a few positive notes to end on.
Okay.
There are just a couple of interesting things that I found that are, you know, trying to address these issues. There is a relief fund for sexual assault victims. That's the name of it, Relief Fund for Sexual Assault Victims, that collects donations to fulfill the needs of survivors during and after disasters in the U.S. And so right now, you know, their focus is on increasing their services to help survivors who are affected during the pandemic. They operate through every kind of health emergency, disaster or crisis. And so if you are interested in helping support survivors or families, you can donate to them. There's also, this one is one of my favorites, and this applies to the larger umbrella of gender-based violence. It's an organization called RISE. They're a DC-based nonprofit, and they actually wrote the Survivors Bill of Rights Act of 2016, and they have launched the Survivor Safe Haven. And so they have partnerships with restaurants, pharmacies, and other essential businesses to serve as safe havens for survivors during COVID-19. So, you know, one of the issues I talked about earlier, being isolated in your home, it's really hard to be seen, to be heard. It's really hard to seek help because you can't go anywhere for help. And you can't text or email because somebody's probably reading your messages, and you can't call anywhere because somebody is 4 feet away from you at all times in your space listening. So this organization created a survivor safe haven where you can like go into these businesses. So like, oh, I just have to go pick up some Tylenol, or like, I'm going to go pick up some coffee. And when you enter the business, you give them this code word, Rise Up 19, and they will give you the phone number for the National Sexual Assault Hotline and give you a safe space inside their establishment to like discreetly make the phone call to seek help or services.
That's smart. That's like the bartender. That's like the bartenders who have
the code words.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Yeah, I've seen that on like bathroom stalls, like order this drink if you're in a bad situation.
Right.
Yeah, so you can look up the Survivor Safe Haven to find a place near you where you can hopefully try to discreetly find a safe place to make a important phone call that you need to make. So on that note, if you or someone you know is experiencing sexual violence, you can visit RAINN, RAINN.org, or you can call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-HOPE.
You can listen to Harpy Hour on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. Wherever you listen, please rate us and leave us a review.
And if you have anything you'd like to share with us, or you just want to say hello, you can email us at harpyhourpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at harpyhourpod.
And we are also on Patreon. So if you're feeling generous and want to donate some extra money, we'll take it off your hands and we will give you some good extra content. So head on over to Patreon and check out our levels. Please donate to us to keep us on the air. Thanks for listening. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.